Bienvenido.
Bienvenidos.
Magandang araw sa inyo.
Dobrý deň.
Bienvenue.
Volcherov.
Here on Earth.
Here on Earth.
Welcome to Here on Earth.
Here on Earth.
Bienvenido a Here on Earth.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, the chocolate room. Hold your breath. Make a wish. Count to three. Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin.
That's Gene Wilder in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the 1971 movie adaptation of the children's classic by Roald Dahl, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, which gave a whole generation of American children the notion that chocolate was made by Oompa Loompas in mysterious Oz-like factories. Despite the fact that chocolate is fast reaching the status of wine or coffee, few chocolate lovers actually know where chocolate comes from or how it's made. Did you know, for instance, that Theobroma cacao, the source of every chocolate bar and truffle ever made, is actually a fruit, a big pendulous pod the size and shape of a football that looks like parrots and macaws when it sprouts right out of the tree trunk in shades that range from bright green to dark purple to burnt orange. I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. This hour, chocolate, the food of the gods. We'll talk with a food historian from a family of Cuban cacao farmers, find out what goes into a chocolate tasting, and get a recipe for fail-proof ganache from a famous chocolatier. Do you find yourself eating more chocolate at this time of year? Have your tastes in chocolate changed from M&M's to Valrhona? We're at 1-800-642-1234. Again, that's 1-800-642-1234. If you're listening online, you can send your messages to us by email. The address is hereonearth@wpr.org. We have Maricel Prezia joining us. She is the culinary historian who comes from a family of cacao farmers. She has a PhD in medieval history from NYU. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Savour, Food and Wine, and Gourmet. She's the president of Gran Cacao, an importer of premium heirloom cacao beans, and the chef and co-owner of Zafra, a pan-Latin restaurant in New Jersey. She's the author of several books, including The New Taste of Chocolate, which is really a magnificent work. Ms. Prezia, welcome to Here on Earth. Hello.
Yes, hi, Jean. How are you?
I'm very well. It's very good.
That was a great introduction, by the way. Thank you very much.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I certainly did.
So you grew up with chocolate.
I certainly did.
Tell us about your first taste.
My first taste, sitting under a mango tree in my grandmother's farm in northeastern Cuba, and actually wondering why this wonderful fruit that I was eating didn't taste like Hershey bonbons, like Hershey Kisses.
You write in the first chapter in your book that you expected the pod to be filled with
chocolate, with chocolate kisses, which was my favorite at the time. I wasn't really disappointed. I was very curious because I wasn't expecting it. I wasn't expecting a fruit that tasted so delicious. It was like a lychee.
And it's white? I mean, the seeds are...
It's white. Mm. When you cut open the cacao pod, you explain that it looks like a football. What you find inside is a mass of beans, and they're enveloped in a pulp, which is somehow acidic, but also, you know, can be sweet. And it's really delicious.
Mm.
And you just suck on those beans. But you don't bite into the beans, because if you do bite into them, it's like tasting aspirin.
Oh, really?
They're very bitter, and they don't taste like chocolate at all.
Uh-huh. You know, it always amazes me how human beings figured out that such a thing, would ultimately produce something that we know as a delicious chocolate bar.
I think it's a common sense process. And the first to do that were probably the Olmecs in Mesoamerica, followed by the Maya. And actually, they treated cacao beans in the same way that they treated other foods, like pumpkin seeds. They toasted them.
Uh-huh.
And actually, that's where, you know, they discovered that they had changed, you know, the taste of the seed into something more transcendental that could be used as a food.
I see. So it was actually a process that they were familiar with.
They applied those processes, like drying, to other foods, like chiles, for example. Then they toasted. They toasted the beans the same way they do with chiles.
Mm-hmm.
Even today in Mexico, and then they ground into a paste, and that's where they discover really chocolate.
Now,
used for drinks.
Where does the fermentation come in?
Well, actually, fermentation comes later. Fermentation takes place naturally. If you cut open a pot of cacao and you scoop out the beans, and you, of course, there is a moment of transition. You know, while you're drying. Those beans. Well, some fermentation takes place, but not a complete fermentation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, fermentation, as the process that we know today, took place later with the Spaniards.
Now, it seems to me that wine certainly has to be fermented in order to be made into
wine. Exactly, and other foods like vanilla. Vanilla has to be fermented.
I didn't know that.
Is very similar to that of cacao.
And, of course, cheese has to be fermented.
Exactly.
Does coffee have to be fermented?
In a way, yes. all great foods need fermentation.
So that's what I was driving at.
But let me explain how it's done.
Yeah.
So imagine you're in a cacao plantation, which is actually a lovely place, because cacao grows under the shade of beautiful trees. This is a dark, dark, mysterious place. And you have cacao workers coming to the trees during the peak of the harvest, and examining, you know, the trees for signs of, you know, maturing pods. And it's a hard thing to tell, actually, when cacao is ripe, but they do know. They cut the cacao, which grows straight from the trunk of the trees, with actually the poles of wood that are, you know, with a knife in one end. They have to be very careful doing that. Then they cut open.
They have to be careful because, first of all, the pod is...
Because cacao grows together with the flowers. So you have a mature cacao pod, together with beautiful flowers and developing cacao pods.
As you put it, Lilliputian flowers beside Gulliver-like pods.
Dean, you really read the book. Thank you.
Well, the descriptions are so vivid and so fantastic.
Well, I'm glad you liked them because I put a lot of effort in that.
Yeah.
Well, so you have those Lilliputian cacao pods growing together with this gigantic pods. But then you have tiny flowers. So when you're cutting off the pod, you have to be extremely careful. So usually women are the ones that cut open the cacao pod.
Really?
So they cut them in half, you know, crosswise. And then they pull out the seeds, which are, you know, the seeds are actually together. They're kept together by kind of placenta.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes into a basket, which is covered by planting leaves, and taken to a central location where those beans are placed in a wooden box covered with planting leaves and left to ferment.
Mm.
And that mass of cacao, imagine, you know, this looks white. It looks like something very strange. It doesn't look like chocolate at all at this point.
It's sort of wormy looking.
Exactly, like worms, live worms. And at that point, actually, the pulp is called cacao en baba, which basically means slime. Baba means slime in Spanish, so it's a very good term for that. So that mass has to be moved often, has to be aerated, so the fermentation process can take place thoroughly. This mass is covered with planting leaves, again, visited periodically. And according to the variety of cacao, that's how long it will take. For a type of cacao called criollo, which actually is the finest in the world, the process is short, usually 2 or 3 days, even shorter. For a type of cacao called forastero, which actually when you cut open the cotyledon, you know, the bean, you find that it's very dark purple, the process is much longer.
Mm.
And what happens is that the sugars turn into alcohol and then into acetic acid. And basically all that pulp washes out, turns into vinegar. In the process, the vegetative life of the bean dies out. So actually, the bean is dead.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is that there are a number of chemical reactions occurring within the bean once the embryo is dead. And you have the development of the so-called chocolate flavor precursors. So essentially, what this means is that without fermentation, without full fermentation, you do not get full chocolate flavor. This is very important.
Ah, so this is one of the steps along the way.
One of the steps that is fundamental.
Determines the outcome.
Determines quality.
Quality. Mm-hmm.
It's one of the many steps from the plantation to the factory that determines quality.
Okay.
So then the beans are, when they're ready, and of course, as I said to you, it depends on the type of cacao. Some cacaos take much longer than others. And the beans have to be examined continuously. So basically you have the owners of the plantation, the workers, cutting open the cotyledons with a knife to examine the changes within the bean. They know when the cacao is ready.
I see.
And you have to take that cacao out of those beans and actually spread them out on the floors.
That's the drying.
Yeah, it could be cement floor. It could be a wooden floor.
And then the roasting comes after this?
It comes after sun drying. Actually, when I say sun drying, I'm talking about progressive factories, progressive plantations that do have the capacity to do that. In some parts of the world, for example, in Indonesia, where it rains a lot during the harvest season, they use wood fires to dry the cacao, and that affects flavor.
Oh,
as
I can
result,
imagine.
You get like a hammy flavor.
Yeah,
in some beans.
Smoky, yeah.
In some places, for example, parts of Brazil, they use gasoline generators, and that also affects flavor because cacao absorbs everything.
Well, you wouldn't want gasoline.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So sun drying is the best.
Because
there are all kinds of enzymatic changes.
Most natural.
Taking place naturally while those beans are sun dried. The problem is that in cacao producing countries, it rains a lot during the harvest.
I see.
So in some cases, when there's not a roof, for example, a plastic roof covering, you know, the drying yards, you have to rush to the field and basically get those beans out of there before they get wet, and then spread them out again when it stops raining.
So there are lots of steps along the way where things can go really wrong.
And of course, you know, what happens is that there has to be a process of selection according to size and quality.
Like coffee beans.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that happens right after drying, and then the beans are shipped to the factory. But of course, it takes months sometimes for a container of cacao to reach a factory. You have to ship in containers. Some containers are ventilated, others are not. And there's some sweating that can take place. There are all kinds of problems. Insect infestation. So, you know, the journey of cacao from the plantation to the factory is quite perilous.
Amazing story. We're talking this hour with Maricel Prezilla. Her book is The New Taste of Chocolate. I'm Jean Ferraca. You're listening to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, where the Friday edition of the program is all about food. Today, all about chocolate. We're at 1-800-642-1234. What's your most memorable chocolate experience? And I'm interested in knowing whether your ideas about what great chocolate is have changed in the last several years or so. Again, it's 1-800-642-1234.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include the UW-Madison Arboretum, welcoming families to learn about animals in winter on Saturday. Eat, Sleep, or Flee is a two-hour program especially for kids beginning at 1 p.m. Information on the web at uwarboretum.org.
The most universal definition of the slave is a stranger torn from kin and country. In Lose Your Mother, Saidiya Hartman journeys along a slave route in Ghana, following the trail of captives in search of her own genealogy. She joins us Monday at 3, here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. I'm Jean Ferraca.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include the Madison Concourse Hotel, offering live jazz in the bar every Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday evenings from 8:30 until midnight. Details online at concoursehotel.com.
I'm Jean Faraca. This is Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, where this hour it's all about chocolate. Maricel Prezilla is with us. She's written a marvelous book about the history of the cacao and how it goes from pod to the kind of ambrosia that we're used to enjoying in all kinds of ways. Now joining us, Nick Malgieri. He is the director of the baking department at Peter Kump's Cooking School in New York and a frequent lecturer on baking and confectionery at cooking schools across the country. He's written for Gourmet, Food and Wine, Chocolatier, as well as the New York Times and Ladies' Home Journal. He's the author of several books, including Chocolate, From Simple Cookies to Extravagant Showstoppers. Mr. Malgieri, welcome to Here on Earth.
Thank you.
I have to tell you, I have never perused a book that has so many recipes, absolutely mouth-dropping, drooly recipes.
And there's chocolate in every one.
Incredible. And I noticed that you dedicated the book to your father.
Yes.
From whom you had your first taste of chocolate. Can you tell us about that?
Well, my father was a candy lover, and chocolate was definitely among the things that he enjoyed. And I remember his giving me treats of chocolate bars as a child.
Where?
I grew up in New Jersey, in Newark.
Ah, you're both from New Jersey.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Do you remember any particular kind of chocolate bar?
Well, there were a bunch of different kinds. One of them, which made a real impression on me at a certain point, was a bar of Dutch orange-flavored white chocolate. And I remember my father giving it to me and saying, you know, what do you think this is? And I remember tasting it and thinking, well, gee, this tastes like chocolate, but it doesn't look like chocolate. And so it was a kind of fun little confusing chocolate game.
Yeah, disconnect. Now, I've heard various things about white chocolate. Some people claim that it's not real chocolate. What's your opinion?
Well, there are a lot of opinions about white chocolate. Basically, to be real chocolate, something has to have cocoa solids, which are ground up, as you were talking about before, fermented, dried, and roasted cocoa beans mm-hmm. in it. What the best quality white chocolate has as its chocolate element is good quality cocoa butter, which is the fat that's pressed from cocoa beans.
Uh-huh.
And the worst quality white chocolate, unfortunately, probably just has some hard vegetable fat and just a little bit of maybe artificial chocolate flavor.
Mm. So tell us how your taste in chocolate has become refined, starting with that first chocolate bar that your father introduced you to. What's your favorite way of eating chocolate nowadays?
And usually with my mouth.
What form does it take?
Well, you know, I'm not a chocolate snob. I like all different kinds of chocolate. Uh-huh. I think different kinds of chocolate have relative merit. Chocolates that are produced in different parts of the world, as Maricel was saying before, have different characteristics. You know, the basic cacao, whether it's Criollo or Forastero or any of the other sub-varieties now that have been hybridized, all produce chocolates with different kinds of characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, and starting, I think, probably about 20 years ago, the more high cocoa solid content chocolates which are more bittersweet, have started to become more popular.
Uh-huh.
Mainly because I think they were not very available before.
Mm.
And this is something that chocolate makers have ventured into a little bit more recently. But, you know, it makes me sick when I hear chocolate snobs say, oh, well, I only like very bittersweet chocolate, because, you know, there's very good semi-sweet chocolate, and there's also very good milk chocolate of many different kinds. And
What is your favorite form of chocolate to cook with, to bake with?
I don't think I understand what you mean.
Well, when you are making one of your fabulous desserts, what kind of chocolate do you use?
You mean what brand?
What form? I'm not a baker, so I'm sorry if this is a naive question.
What form? You mean whether it's bittersweet or semi-sweet or...
Yeah, what do you use? Baker's chocolate? Do you make a ganache?
That's a brand.
Uh-huh. Do you make a ganache? Is that the way to start?
Okay. I think we're using a whole lot of different terms. And what I understand by a form of chocolate is, am I using solid chocolate or am I using cocoa powder? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Do you have different varieties?
Well, different recipes call for different kinds of preparations.
Okay.
So, for example, if you were making, say, a chocolate truffle, mm-hmm. you would use semi-sweet or bittersweet chocolate or maybe a combination of several different kinds of chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 4 or 5 parts of bittersweet and 1 part milk chocolate.
Okay.
So that would be one type of preparation. If you were making a chocolate sponge cake, you probably would be using cocoa powder as the chocolate element in that because it is going to blend more easily with the other ingredients. If I were making a devil's food cake, then I would probably, because it's the traditional American type of chocolate to use for that, I'd be using unsweetened chocolate.
Okay.
So there really isn't there isn't a blanket, and I think, you know, Maricel is probably still on the line there. She can chime in anytime she wants to. There really isn't any one particular kind of chocolate that is what you would call an all-purpose chocolate, like all-purpose flour.
Mm.
Different kinds of preparations, depending upon what their use is and what you're aiming for, are going to utilize different types of chocolate.
Maricel, how do you recognize really fine chocolate? What is the difference between a really fine chocolate and something that's not so great?
Hi, Nick.
Hi, Maricel.
I didn't know you would be in the show. Great. Well, that's a charge question. But for me, I look intensity of flavor. I look for complexity of flavor. I like a chocolate that will, you know, the taste of chocolate will remain in my mouth for a long time. That, you know, chocolate that will have a lingering effect.
Mm-hmm.
I particularly like chocolates with fruitiness, the fruitiness of a dry fruit, let's say dried cherries or raisins. And, of course, those elements of flavor depend on the type of beans used in the chocolate. Of course, you know, some manufacturers have better equipment than others and can produce maybe a smoother type of chocolate, but nothing changes the flavor of a chocolate made with bad beans.
Mm-hmm.
Bad beans produce inferior, mediocre, or bad chocolate.
Yeah, can I add something there, Maricel?
Sure.
I was at a chocolate tasting recently that was conducted by Gary Guittard, who has a... chocolate. His family's been in the chocolate business in the San Francisco area for about 150
exactly.
years.
Yes.
And he went to great lengths to get a plantation that he deals with to produce some under-fermented and over-fermented beans for him. And then they took and they made chocolate out of those under-fermented and over-fermented beans
mm-hmm.
so that everyone at the tasting could experience the, you know, very exaggerated flavor of that. And it was really interesting. The under-fermented beans tasted like they had some kind of weird chemical chlorine type of
chlorine.
A taste.
Sometimes they have a greenish taste.
Yeah, very, very, very interesting.
So you see, it's what I was talking about. You know, fermentation is key,
mm-hmm.
and it has to be a carefully monitored process. So there are many variables in terms of, you know, quality.
Yeah, and you know
what
I'm really glad you mentioned that business about the the wood drying and the wood fire drying and the gasoline drying, because sometimes you get these perceptions of taste in chocolate that they're trying to palm off as a high-priced, high-quality chocolate.
Exactly, because they're...
And you taste it and you say to yourself, well, wait a minute, what is this stuff, you know?
Well, because, first of all, you know, we're talking about origins that seem very remote. For example, Indonesia, Java, it all sounds very exotic, but actually isn't Indonesia particularly where they use the wood fires to dry cacao.
Right, and they do the same thing with the vanilla, you know.
They certainly do.
So their vanilla is excessively smoky tasting. In fact, I don't think that many of the big American vanilla producers at this point are even dealing with Indonesian beans anymore.
But it's the second, and Indonesia is the second producer of vanilla in the world, actually.
Yeah.
Okay.
Second to Madagascar.
We have some callers who've been waiting to join this conversation. I want to get to them. Jack is joining us from Eagle River. And we have open lines for anyone else. We're talking about chocolate this hour. 1-800-642-1234. Jack, thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
I'm joining these two, but here goes. The thing I like about chocolate in particular is how it blends in alcoholic beverages. You take Bailey's, for example, or the way they use chocolate in brewing beer. I had a beer, a porter beer, last week, and it just had a hint of chocolate, and it kind of gave it a more of a boldness and more of a flavor. So what do you think about that?
I'm all for it. I make a fantastic chocolate drink with Venezuelan rum.
Uh-huh.
And lots of spices. It's just wonderful.
How do you make it, Maricel?
Well, I make hot chocolate with with a very good quality chocolate, and I basically steep the milk with spices. I use allspice. I use star anise, cinnamon, cloves, and I basically steep the milk for a little while, and I add the chunks of chocolate, and I dissolve the chocolate, and after that I add some rum. I like very aged rums from Latin America. I love Venezuelan rum. I love Zacapa, which is a Guatemalan rum. Fantastic.
Mm. You know, Maricel, we never determined where cacao actually grows, and it's in a belt, I understand.
Yes.
Around the world.
Exactly.
It's just 20 miles from the equator.
Yeah, it's a tropical belt. Mm. Twenty degrees north and south of the equator.
And that's it.
Does the
tree always grow in a tropical forest, in a jungle?
Yes, it needs shade, it needs humidity.
Uh-huh. So how do you cultivate a tree has to be a complex of trees? I mean, I don't understand that.
Well, simple. If you're going to start a plantation, you can start a plantation from scratch, or you can use a forested area. You have to clear it if you're using a forested area and plant the trees so that they can get some sun, but then they will grow shelter. But if you're starting from scratch, as I saw, for example, in the plains of Venezuela, in the state of Barinas, they cleared the land completely, and they started planting the so-called tutors that will protect the cacao as it grows. And afterwards, they planted the cacao trees. And actually, they did something else. They planted plantains and yucca together with the cacao, so they would grow together, and they developed, you know, a whole forest out of nothing, out of a plain, where
Amazing.
Nothing grew.
Jackie is next. Thank you, Jack. Jackie joins us from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Jackie. Go ahead.
Just love your show, and thanks for having me on. It's so funny that I'm listening to your show. I'm driving home with some unsweetened cocoa for making hot chocolate. I've got some extra chocolate in the backseat, getting ready for the Valentine's Day addiction.
Uh-huh.
But I teach smoking cessation classes, and years ago when I smoked and quit smoking, I didn't have an affinity for chocolate. It would you could take it or leave it, and I knew chocolate is M&Ms and Snickers and things like that. Some older, wiser person said, if you're having trouble and you feel like you want a cigarette, try a piece of dark chocolate, which I tasted it, and it was kind of bitter. I found that it reduced my cravings, and then when I started teaching smoking cessation classes, I helped other students find darker chocolate and say, when you're having a craving, try this, and it seems to be working. I don't know why, but it seems like something in the brain, chocolate seems to soothe when people are edgy or something like that. And I found it interesting. I don't think there's any science behind it, but chocolate seems to help with people who are giving up bad habits.
That is very interesting. Did you become addicted to chocolate?
I'm afraid I am. I'm afraid I have four different kinds in my refrigerator and freezer at all times. And but, you know, it's a passion that I enjoy it with a glass of red wine, or I'll have it for dessert, but you don't need a lot of it, and I think it's better than saying having a whole, bunch of candies. I think the dark chocolate's rich and satisfying, and so you don't need a lot of it.
Well, I bet there is some science that explains that.
Yeah, I think there is, because the bromine that's in the chocolate definitely acts on the brain somewhat, and I think it provides a light stimulus in a slightly similar way to the way that nicotine works.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
And a lot safer.
And some people claim that it has there's a euphoria that is attached to chocolate. I don't know if there's a science to that, but...
Yes, there is.
Is there?
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
No, I couldn't explain it to you in a simple form, but there is a lot of research about, you know, the... effect of chocolate in mood and behavior.
A mood elevator.
Mm-hmm.
Joyce is next. Thank you, Jackie. Joyce joins us from Milwaukee. Go ahead, Joyce.
Hi. I just am so excited about this program because I'm a teacher, a middle school teacher. I teach technology, and we're just finishing up a study of chocolate. We've been studying the history of chocolate, how to grow chocolate, how to process the cocoa bean, everything, and the kids are making PowerPoint presentations, and they're studying in language arts, and we're watching Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. We're doing so many things, and we're making a chocolate cookbook, and we're ending it on Valentine's Day with a chocolate tasting party. So I was so excited when I turned on the radio on my way home from school and heard about chocolate.
Perfect.
So thank you.
Perfect. Oh, great.
Thank you. Let's
go to Maricel for the question on how to create a chocolate tasting party.
Well, what I have done in the past when tasting chocolate is that usually I select chocolates that have a similar cacao content.
Mm-hmm.
For, let's say, you know, a 60% or, you know, perhaps higher, 70%. Although I have to confess that I do not like, you know, very bitter chocolates.
Glad you said that.
In fact, I cook with, you know, I like a 58%.
Yeah. Maricel, hold on, because the music tells us that we're coming up on a break. We'll continue this in just a minute. We're talking this hour about chocolate. My guests are Maricel Prezilla, who is the author of The New Taste of Chocolate, Nick Malgieri, who is the author of Chocolate, From Simple Cookies to Extravagant Showtoppers. We have open lines. You can join us. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. What's your most memorable chocolate experience? Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders is the interactive radio show that features voices from all over the world. How about yours? The program airs live weekday afternoons at 3 Central Time, and podcast listeners can stream the show at our website, hereonearth.org. To join the conversation, call toll-free in the United States and Canada, 1-800-642-1234. Elsewhere, drop us an email, hereonearth@wpr.org. Leave your phone number and we'll call you back. You can also post your thoughts at our web forum or leave a message at my blog. We're Radio Without Borders, here on Earth, from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's all about chocolate this hour on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. I'm Jean Faraca. We have open lines now and room for you in this conversation. It's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is hereonearth@wpr.org. We had a call from David in Michigan who wants to let us know that chocolate has caffeine and other caffeine-like substances in it, which would lend credence to the idea that it is, in fact, a stimulant. And let's go to Ellen in Milwaukee. Hi, Ellen. Go ahead.
Hi there. I have a comment and then kind of a question sort of thing. I've been reading a lot about the fungus that's been attacking a lot of the cacao trees, and wondering what's happening with that, because that's been going a long time, I think. Also, I would think that a way to really get people more interested in saving the forested areas of the world is, if everybody in the world loves chocolate, and if we don't have them, the forested areas, we're not going to have chocolate. And then going along with the cessation of cigarette smoking, I lost about 50 pounds using basically chocolate to do it, which is counterintuitive.
It is.
I gave myself permission. I just wrote down everything I ate, and I gave my permission to have chocolate for breakfast, lunch, dinner, whatever I wanted to. And there were days I had maybe 800 calories in dark chocolate, but I was satisfied. And usually I start my day with, you know, maybe three little pieces of dark chocolate, and it's a variation
on the Atkins diet.
And it's very healthy to food.
Do you love chocolate with coffee?
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, it's a great combination, isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah, first thing in the morning, when your taste buds are at their most innocent.
and then any time through the rest of the day as well.
Well, that's really interesting. Thank you, Ellen. And what about that question, Maricel, about if more people knew about the where cacao grows, how it's produced, the complexity of the process, do you think it would contribute?
Absolutely.
To our saving
of... It would contribute to our understanding of the food that we love most, which is chocolate, but also we would pay attention to the land, and we would pay attention to the plea of cacao workers all over the world, and we would try to save the best varieties of cacao, which are being unfortunately depleted because of disease and neglect. She was talking about
the fungus.
She was talking, yeah, which is broom, which actually decimated the Brazilian cacao industry. Mm. At one point, Brazil was the largest producer of cacao in the world, and certainly, you know, a few years ago, it was the largest producer of Latin America. But witch's broom decimated the plantations of Bahia in the northeast of Brazil. How to combat that? Well, first of all, what happened in Bahia is that they planted, you know, most of the plantations were based on one type of cacao of the Forastero kind. And what happens when you depend on one variety, you know, one type of disease can wipe out a complete plantation. So variety is, you know, is a key element in combating these outbreaks of disease. The scientists have developed hybrids that are more resistant to witch's broom, and so there is you know, steady progress. But Brazil will never get back, you know, to its role as a great producer of cacao anymore.
You know, I remember hearing the same thing said about Brazil's coffee industry, that they had the same kind of problem, with a different fungus, of course.
A different kind of disease, but it happens when you depend on one variety of plant. So, you know, you have to have diversity. Mm. Biological diversity is key.
Okay. Marty is next in Portage. Hi, Marty. Go ahead.
Hello. Yes. Just want to mention, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Togo, West Africa, along the border with Ghana, up in the mountains, and each of the schools used to have coffee and cocoa fields, trees, plantations, and they would harvest the cocoa beans and sell them and use them to buy school supplies and things for the schools. Also, I remember a lot of times during the harvesting season, the kids would be crossing the mountains into Ghana to come back with sacks of cocoa beans that they would sell in Togo for a better currency, and the kids would all be tired and sleeping in class because after school they would trek the mountains and then carry about 100-pound bags of cocoa beans into Togo.
That's
But they dried their cocoa beans and everything by sun, naturally, and any time a rainstorm would be coming, they'd have to run out and
exactly.
cover the cocoa beans.
Mm.
And
mm.
then after it stopped raining, they'd go back out there and take off the palm leaves and straw and all that to let the beans dry again.
Mm.
That's the life of a cacao plantation.
And I wonder, Maricel, do you know anything about the cocoa cooperatives that are organized now in Ivory Coast?
Well, you know, there are cooperatives all over the cacao producing world because there have been an outcry
mm-hmm.
Because of, you know, unfair work conditions and the problem with children working in some of these plantations. And there's such a thing as a fair trade now. Not everybody subscribes to that, and it's a very complicated issue that it will take a program to discuss. But yes, in many places there are cooperatives because cacao has been traditionally produced by small workers. So you have groups of cacao producers that are very small producers banding together.
You mentioned the plight of the cacao farmer. We have heard, for example, that in places like Ivory Coast, the typical farmer can't afford or has never tasted chocolate.
Well, it's not a traditional food.
Yeah.
Cacao arrived in Africa with the Portuguese. Actually, it was Brazilian. It was Brazilian cacao of a type called amelonado that was brought to Africa, and that's the kind of cacao that is grown all over. Especially in West Africa is a great producer.
Mm.
It's actually the largest producer of cacao in the world, followed by Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
But the cacao they grow is forastero, and they don't make chocolate. But that's also the story in Latin America. The tradition in Latin America is not of making chocolate desserts, but making drinks.
Yeah, cocoa.
Exactly.
Hot chocolate.
I don't call it cocoa. I hate that word.
I'm sorry. And it was, as you mentioned, the Olmecs who started it, and then the Mayans, and then the Toltecs, and then the Aztecs.
The Aztecs who imported, you know, because they couldn't grow cacao.
It was used
in their region because it was high and cold, so it was brought as a tribute.
Oh, I see. And how is it used in their religious rites?
Well, it was an offering. It was an offering to the gods.
I see.
So, and it was consumed by the elite class.
Uh-huh. And the theobroma actually means food of the gods.
Exactly. But that's, you know, it's something that came later, and it had nothing to do with, with the Aztecs.
Okay. Carlos joins us next from Waukesha.
So it was consumed by the elite class. The theobroma.
Oops. Carlos, are you? You have to turn your radio on. I'm sorry. That was confusing.
I'm sorry. I couldn't understand what he was saying.
We were hearing an echo of what we had just said, which was a little bit strange. We'll go to Bob next in Milwaukee. Again, Milwaukee. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Jean. I just want clarification, if possible, on a little scrap of information I got long ago when talking about the health benefits of chocolate, dark chocolate in particular.
Mm-hmm.
I recall hearing that the best kind for health benefits is not a Swiss process, but rather some other process.
Absolutely,
something that has not been
alkalized.
What's that?
Do you know what alkalization is? You know, adding alkali to maybe to cacao beans. Or to the cacao mass.
And why is alkaline?
If you alkalize, what happens is that, well, first, let's not talk about cocoa powder because that's how alkalis came to be used, you know, to treat cocoa powder. But in terms of chocolate, what happens is that most manufacturers use forasteros, cacao, in their formulations because, first of all, it's the most abundant cacao in the world.
Forastero.
As I said, you know, Africa, West Africa being the largest producer, right? Well, they produce forastero cacao. Now, remember when we were talking about fermentation, when you cut open the cotyledons of a cacao bean,
mm-hmm.
That is a forastero bean, it's deep purple. If you taste it, it tastes like an aspirin. It's very, very bitter and astringent and acidic. Well, even if when you dry it, you know, it becomes mellow when you dry it.
Mm.
But if you make chocolate straight from that, you have to add an enormous amount of sugar in order to tame those negative notes of flavor.
Mm-hmm.
So what manufacturers have traditionally done is that they add an alkali. And alkalization actually tones down bitterness and acidity. And you don't have to add that much sugar. Although traditionally, you know, chocolate, especially in this country, has been sweetened to death.
So I'm a little confused.
So, but that process destroys, you know, the positive health benefits
the
of that process of cacao. Is also known as the Dutch process.
Dutch, exactly. That started, you know, in the making of cocoa powder. But it's used for cacao beans.
Mm-hmm.
And it's used for the, you know, for the cacao mass. To basically, you know, to eliminate that astringency and bitterness of Forastero cacao, which is most inexpensive in the market.
I see.
I mean, the elite cacao is Criollo and a hybrid of Forastero and Criollo called Trinitario. Very expensive. Right now, the prices are to the roof. Like, for example, starting at $4,000, $5,000 per metric ton and going up, And in some regions and some plantations, the prices are maybe $15,000 per metric ton.
Wow.
So translate that if you are a company, you're making chocolate, so you would have to charge the public a lot of money to use very good cacao. But the situation here is that these companies that alkalize are now hearing, you know, the buzz that alkalinization is a problem. So some companies like Mars, which actually spearheaded the research on the health benefits of chocolate, have a proprietary method to deal with the situation and to create a chocolate that still retains the health benefits, you know, of a cacao high in polyphenols, which are antioxidant substances.
Okay. Nick, what do you have to contribute to this?
Well, you know, chocolate, though, I have to say, is something that we eat for pleasure, and it's not a medicine. You know, a lot of foods have health benefits, like broccoli. But, you know, we're doing a show about chocolate because people love chocolate and people enjoy eating chocolate. And, you know, everything from a Snickers bar on up to the fanciest, say, imported French chocolate, which is made from that $15,000 a ton cocoa bean. You know, chocolate is something that has really wide appeal, and there's something in it for everybody.
And do you think that if we stop thinking of chocolate eating as sinful and start thinking of
I don't think of anything eating as sinful, really. But
anything in moderation is not sinful.
But the question
is you know, I love the comment made by the lady who said that she used rewards of chocolate on her weight reduction diet because you really can't be so virtuous that you're avoiding everything that's got a couple of extra calories in it, or else you're going to be thin and miserable.
Carlos joins us from Waukesha. Hi, Carlos.
Hi. Hi. Yes, I just want to make a comment. It's a good, really good topic. And I'm from Chiapas, and nearby to a little town named Cacahuatan, which means the land of cacao.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that I want to mention is because I don't eat chocolate anymore, well, at least in a few things, because my mom in an early age gave us too much chocolate and for breakfast almost every single day with plantains. And maybe it's why I don't eat chocolate anymore. Like, but I see people that love chocolate, you know, and I grew up in a cacao plantation, basically.
So, Carlos, your mother used to make hot chocolate for you. Was that it?
Yeah, I used to, and you know, beating from the with hot water and pure chocolate with not too much sugar, so which maybe I get a little sick of too much chocolate. That's why I don't eat chocolate.
Well,
chocolate overkill.
That's an interesting.
That's a turn for me.
That's really interesting. Thank you, Carlos. We'll go to Doris next in Shawano. Hi, Doris. Go ahead.
Wonderful program. I'd like to know how to store some wonderful chocolate candy for about 10 months.
Oh, don't store it. Just eat it.
Yeah, 10 months sounds like kind of a long time to store chocolate candies. Now, if it's plain, unfilled, and unmixed chocolate, so if you've got pure, unadulterated chocolate. Mm. If you store it well wrapped up, not in plastic wrap, which can impart a flavor to the chocolate, but well wrapped up in aluminum foil, and you keep it in a cool, dark place, dark chocolate should be fine for 10 months. Milk and white chocolate might start developing a little bit of staleness because of the natural milk that's in it. But chocolate candies, which might have the chocolate mixed with cream or another dairy product or another ingredient like that, probably won't stay fresh for that long a time.
Okay. Tom is next in Madison. Hi, Tom.
Well, hello. What a wonderful topic. Just a couple of, I hope, interesting comments. A long time ago, a friend of mine had told me that the opposite of spicy was sweet. And after having some very spicy Cajun food, popped the chocolate bar in my mouth and found that it just cooled it right down.
How interesting.
And then contrary to that, or maybe complementary to that, I recently had some chocolate that was mixed with wasabi.
Ooh.
Which was one of the most interesting flavors I have ever had. And I just wanted to find out how you felt about that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Oh, that's really interesting. And you remind me, Tom, of my favorite combination, which is a really good dark chocolate with candied ginger.
That's a great combination.
It is a good combination.
Yeah, it's like yin and yang. You know, they're just such opposites that they seem like they have to be married. Well, I want to thank you both very, very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This was a wonderful program.
It was just great to have you both with us.
Enjoy your chocolate.
Yes, you do.
Happy Valentine's.
And same to you. Maricel Prezilla and Nick Malgieri. And you can find out more about them by going to our website. That's www.hereonearth.org. You'll find links to each of their books and some delicious chocolate recipes when you go there. Let's see, what else do you need to know? A copy of today's program can be had by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 29K. Here on Earth was produced this hour by Joe Hartke, Carmen Jackson, Lisa Nett, and Dan Rosinski-Larson, with the cooperation of the Division of International Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, international.wisc.edu. I'm Jean Faraca. Thanks for listening.